Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
We have emails, and I have gone through all of them and chosen three in particular that all say almost exactly the same thing about our last episode. And specifically, it was about this study out of Italy, out of Bologna, Pia Campagiani, looking at whether students rated professors differently if they were male or female. And the answer is yes, unfortunately, they do.
Significantly.
Yes. Men get better ratings than women. Same lecture, same material, better ratings for men, worse ratings for women. In these three different emails, they're each talking about kind of how we set up that segment or how we tried to recreate it. So Pia's study was in Italian. That's very problematic for a show like this one that's in English.
Yeah.
And so what she did is she delivered me this lecture that they used.
In Italian.
In Italian.
And then you had it translated.
Yeah. It was on glory, the philosophical idea of glory. Very kind of dry stuff. And then I had two DW colleagues voice it to represent the female lecturer and the male lecturer. And pretty much everyone said how, like, blown away they were by the male lecturer. And specifically, more importantly, this is one email from Jenny. I preferred the professor with the British accent. I will readily admit to having a preference to British accents, and I hope that the gender study eliminated other preferences or stereotypes by comparing male and female. Meaning, like, could this have been the problem? Because the colleague, his name is Neil.
So it wasn't the fact that the voices were male and female, is that one was speaking with a British accent and the other one wasn't?
Yeah, yeah. Another email, and this is from a guy who I don't think we've had an email from before, and it's impossible not to note that his name is Chris Rock.
And did you ask him? Did you reach out and ask him if he is the Chris Rock,
the recipient of the
slap at the Oscars a few years back?
You and I discussed this, and we decided that we were going to assume that it was the famous, the really famous Chris Rock. So thank you to this famous actor for writing in. No, but what this listener said was that it wasn't exactly complimentary. The male speaker came on, and he matched exactly my expectations of a Roman philosopher. Pompous, authoritative, aristocratic, naturally English, etc. And then the final email, and this is from Rebecca. This is the one that I actually sent on to the researcher herself, saying, were several men's and women's voices used when performing the study? Because some of us have a fondness for certain accents, like a quote-unquote charming British accent. So, sent this to Pia, the lead author of the study, and she said it's a very good question, and she got into the methodology of that. They had 20 men and 20 women provide their voices.
All voicing the exact same text.
Right. So they narrowed it down from that high number, but they had 20 and 20, and then they asked a bunch of, this is part of the study, asked a bunch of the participants to rate each of those voices for things like self-confidence, authoritativeness, and kindness, also regionality. We can all have biases. If somebody has a certain accent, you might love it or you might hate it. And so then from those 20-20, they narrowed it down to 4 and 4. And importantly, those 4 and 4 matched each other with regard to those criteria. Mm-hmm. So self-confidence, authoritativeness, kindness, they sounded kind of the same.
Okay.
So, yeah. So thank you to everyone for those emails. And thank you again to Pia for taking the time to answer them and for providing such a wonderful interview on such an interesting topic.
What do you got over there?
Let's go ahead and start with the breakthrough, the medical breakthrough that has made headlines around the world this week. It is potentially a big one, but it does need to be qualified. This is fundamentally that Huntington's disease appears that we can slow this disease down by about 75%.
This is something that we could not do before. If you developed Huntington's disease, there was nothing you could do about it.
Correct. Okay. It's a horrible, 90% of the time, it's genetic. You've inherited this disease. Somebody in your family has probably also passed away as a result of it. It's like...
And what does it do to you?
It's like if you took the worst combinations of Parkinson's disease, neuromotor diseases, and dementia, packed them all together, and then it works in slow motion over the course of years, decades. And so you know this is in you, and you know that you're going to ultimately succumb to it, possibly in, let's say, 2 decades. It tends to become apparent at about the age of 40.
Yeah.
First through the psychological or the emotional intelligence part, mood swings, sudden temper tantrums. Obviously, the dementia begins to set in at some point.
And when you're diagnosed with it, you know that it's always going to keep getting worse and worse and worse, a little bit like Parkinson's disease. And now these researchers have come up with a breakthrough. What is it?
Yeah, so the news in question is that through a really complicated procedure, that's one of the, I don't want to say critical points, but that's one, I'll get to these other scientists who have weighed in later, but it's a 12 to 18 hour operation on your brain. And what they're effectively doing is injecting genetically edited materials into your brain to stop or slow what's happening. So again, they're slowing it down. And to get totally technical about this, effectively you have DNA within your cells, and the DNA is like the instructions, but the instructions need to be taken somewhere so that your cell can create something. Yeah. And that messenger RNA is what does it and accidentally creates toxic junk. It's creating something that's not only useful, it's harmful. And what the...
With the edited cells, that process has been stopped.
Yes.
In one patient or what?
It hasn't been stopped. It's been slowed. What they do is they take that messenger RNA and block it. Hmm. So it's kind of like if I'm telling you, Gabe, go over there and make something.
Yeah.
And it turns out what you're going to make is toxic junk. This intercepts you and blocks you. Like, no, you're not going over there.
Okay.
And that's kind of the whole mechanism. Just stop that message from going over there so that the junk doesn't get created.
Okay.
They've done this. They start off, the number that's being thrown around was 29 people involved in this study. Only 17 got the high dosage. The other group who got the low dosage didn't have an effect. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of fine for this study because they're like, well, we want to figure out, is the high dosage safe? And it appears to be safe. 12 of those they followed for 3 years, and they've seen this 75% slowing, which, again, really big deal, because let's say if I find out today at roughly the age of 40 that I have this disease and it would take 15 years for it to progress to being fatal,
yeah.
Well, now it would take 60.
And based on that dosage, they know that it will have that effect already? Based on looking at them for a short span of time, they know... Based on that degree or extent of damage or degeneration, that it will work?
That appears to be the case. Yeah. I say appears because what we're working with here is the press release from a private company, biotech company, based in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam, and which is different than having a research paper that has been peer-reviewed.
Yeah.
Hence, I waited until a bunch of researchers, independent, from around the world had chimed in on this. I'll just quote them very quickly. One, Professor Roger Barker, University of Cambridge, said, great news, but it does involve injecting something directly into the brain. So that will take time to adopt this across neurologic centers. That's a big ask. That's a lot of procedures. Professor Christopher Shaw, King's College London, says if it is safe in the long term and affordable, then it could prevent people carrying the Huntington's gene mutation from developing symptoms. Breakthrough opens the door to using viral vectors to treat other developmental and degenerative brain diseases. Mm. So that's actually possibly even bigger than this finding itself. And the last one I'll say is that according to Professor Zosia Midzebrotska, she is a clinical director at the University of Aberdeen, professor of medical genetics. She said, really highlights early days. Very, very early days. We'll see, but very exciting. Best results we've seen at this point. But again, please provide the data. Show us the data. Show us what you're working with.
Yeah.
But exciting.
Again, yeah, another instance of gene editing or engineered cells and what it's going to do for human health. I was at my diabetes doctor this week, and I mentioned just in passing while I was there, did you hear about the experiment up in Sweden that we spoke about, I think, a couple of times now? Oh, yeah. And he said, within 5 years, we're not going to need insulin anymore. Like that this CRISPR discovery, gene editing of cells. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huntington's disease. Can you imagine getting this diagnosis and knowing the end is coming?
It's possible. And again,
eventually and now?
And identified.
It's just incomprehensible what that means for the people afflicted.
Yeah. I think 1993, I would have to go back and check my notes, but 1993 was the first time that the genetic properties of the disease were fully understood. Yeah. And from there to now, potentially, through a complicated, expensive, somewhat dangerous procedure in two very specific parts of the human brain,
yeah,
and whose long-term consequences we don't yet understand. But obviously, for a fatal disease of this kind, some risks are absolutely worth the reward.
A little bit more health information here out of Tufts University, the School of Dental Medicine, they did a survey and they found out that young adults in the U.S. between 18 and 35, a third of them skip going to the dentist every year.
A third?
Yeah. And they, that, does that amaze you?
No, because what do we associate dentistry with? Money? Because even here in Germany, it's not funded or it's not covered by health insurance in the same way. Mm. And pain. Terrible. Not like the highest level, not a 10 out of 10, okay. But just electric shocks of pain.
So would, are you one of these one third? Or do you,
yes.
You don't go to the dentist every year?
Not every year. Okay. No. I try. I do my best, but it's...
Then just allow me a public service announcement here to the world. And I totally agree with the doctors at the Tufts School of Dental Medicine. They're saying this is extremely troubling. That so many young kids are skipping the dentist because I for one, there was a point in my life when I didn't go to the dentist for like 5, maybe 10 years.
All right.
And I'm paying the price now. I have periodontal disease. The reason why I have that is that I didn't go to the dentist. And now I have to go to the dentist twice a year and get a deep clean, which means 8 shots of Novocaine in my mouth. Over a 2-day process, it hurts really bad. Because if I don't do that, I might lose my teeth.
That'd be yeah. You don't want to lose those chompers.
Yeah. Periodontal disease is the number one reason, the number one cause of tooth loss around the world. I mean, I don't want to make this too much.
That's the message though from this report or from Tufts that they is that what they're saying? Just go.
That I went with it. I took it and went with it my own direction because it's close to my heart that I want to tell people to go to the dentist because I didn't go to the dentist over that period of time. If I had gone, maybe I would have noticed or maybe a doctor would have noticed.
Would this information have made you go? What would have, I guess that's my question for you. What would have actually made you go?
Maybe hearing someone like me saying that if you don't go to the dentist, this could happen because you don't notice tooth decay. You don't notice it normally until it's too late. Even a cavity, you don't notice you have it until it's too late. And there are the signs that a dentist could see, you don't see. Right?
Go to the dentist.
That's brought
to you by Gabriel Borud and Tufts University. A third of Americans.
Tufts, yeah, 32% of people between the age of 18 and 35 mm-hmm. don't go to the dentist. One of the reasons that they don't go to the dentist, although like you said, was that some of them can't afford the copay. It's an insurance
issue.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last little thing here, Gabe, you talked last week a bit about political violence. In that case, it was the UC Davis and the connection between people who supported or agreed with phobic statements, transphobic statements, xenophobic, racist, sexist.
Yeah, they had 7 different kinds of what they referred to as allophobia. And like you said, those are ideological or psychological states of mind that if you are against certain minority groups, it's more likely if you support those kinds of statements that you would also support acts of political violence. You would condone them.
Right. There's an association there between the people who say yes to the one
and
yes to the other.
Yeah.
Just a little update. I think this is fair and necessary to mention on the show as well. A YouGov survey. YouGov, based out of the UK, they conduct these surveys on a lot of different questions, some of which include whether or not you condone or support political violence, in this case, Americans, people from the United States. And this was done immediately in the aftermath of the assassination of Charlie Kirk, a right-wing political activist. And what they're asking effectively was who supports this, which age groups, which demographics, and a very clear picture emerged from those surveys. And I'll just get to the details. The group that supports it the most are people between the ages of 18 to 29 and to a lesser extent 30 to 44. So younger, the younger you go, the more likely that person is to support an act of political violence in some situations. And then also in the data very clearly, in terms of political ideology, more likely to be very liberal. In that case, 25% of the people who identified or who checked the box, yes, I'm very liberal, said yes, violence can be sometimes justified. To give you a kind of a counterexample of that, if somebody said they were conservative, that number drops down to 6, and very conservative, even lower. I'm not seeing even seeing what that number is here. And so that's a stark difference. And what YouGov itself has made clear to say, just to give this a little context, is they conduct these studies all the time. They've been doing them for years to kind of check in. It's like a barometer for where people are. And that those numbers will shift and shift rather dramatically depending on who's in power and what has just happened. Mm. And so that these numbers had shifted previously when there are attacks on politically motivated attacks on Democratic politicians, yeah. Whereas in the immediate aftermath of an attack on a conservative political commentator or right-wing political commentator, that this is where the pendulum has swung at this point. But it's, I think, important to say that yeah. is what the data shows right now.
And that's straight up quantitative data on who is that person. The study out of UC Davis that we talked about last week was more of a what's going on in the heads or what kind of psychological, again, state of mind is leading to that. And one thing that I definitely wanted to say, I touched on this very briefly last week, is that these statements, these transphobic, homophobic, homonegative, racist, xenophobic statements are very deep-seated. And the researchers said that they are resistant to change, but they did say that there was one way, according to the research. Again, they've been doing years and years of studies on this. And one thing that they found a couple years ago was for people who believed that civil war was necessary for the United States right now, that civil war had to bring about or was one very justified way to bring about change. One way that they found those people could change their minds, these deep-seated beliefs, was if somebody within their family addressed them and more or less tried to change their mind. It was the only way that it actually worked. So if you know somebody who's, I don't know, spouting or seems to be in support of these kinds of allophobic beliefs, if they are in your family, may possibly address it.
Yeah.
Because it has consequences. It could have consequences down the road.
Yeah. It's a big ask. It's a difficult thing to ask. There's the famous, at least in the country we're talking about, in the United States, the famous Thanksgiving dinner dispute. Hmm. Or either you address it head on or do you not? Do you avoid politics at the table? And this would be advocating for the addressing of it, but not, I guess, not necessarily in that setting. It could be a private conversation you have with someone. That's the big, honestly, the big open question that a lot of people have, that we have as well. What do you do if you're concerned that somebody you know personally or through a friend might do something like that? What do I do? Do I contact them? Do I contact their family member? Do I contact the authority? We don't have the answer to that.
It seems from afar. I mean, we're sitting here in Germany. I don't know what it's like to live there right now, but it seems from afar, from what you read in the videos that you see online, those kinds of things are becoming more common. Even though you said in the YouGov study, 80% do not believe at all. It just seems from afar that it's yeah. becoming more inflamed.
I think that's an important message to end on. 80%, roughly, kind of rounding up there, but 80% of people in the United States, if you ask them, do you support political violence of any kind, they say it's quote-unquote unacceptable. And we'll leave it there. Any questions? Anything else to add or subtract from this show? Let us know, su@dw.com. We are joined in studio, Gabe and I, by our DW colleague, Carla Bleicher. First of all, Carla, thanks for coming in today.
Sure thing.
Hi, Carla.
To talk about something personal. It's connected to pain and medicating, I guess, against pain. And to begin here, Carla, I'm just going to quote the beginning or the first line of the article that you wrote for DW.com. And it says this article comes to you a little later than DW Science Team had planned. Why?
Well, I was going to write that article a little while ago. I did an interview for it with a really great expert. But the day I was supposed to write it, I woke up and my wrists and my hands were in so much pain that I couldn't write more than a couple of minutes at a time.
And this is chronic. This is pain that you feel how often and how severely?
It depends. It's almost always there, but at a low level, I would say. But then some days it spikes and then I can't really do much of anything.
Do you know the source of the pain?
No, I do not. I've been to a ton of different doctors and done a ton of different tests, and all they ever say is, oh, you know, no, that looks great. Nothing to see there. Test comes back clear, which is nice, I suppose, but it's also really frustrating because you can't really do anything against it if you don't know where it comes from.
I guess in retrospect, I sort of had a clue to this, but I thought you and I were the only ones in our department, in our hall, that had these ergonomic mice, plural, mouse that you use with a computer. But for me, that was just a little carpal tunnel from overuse. With you, this is just you wake up on any given day and your wrists hurt, or is it just your wrists? Where is it?
Sometimes it's the left wrist, sometimes it's the right, sometimes it's further up the arm, more around the elbow. And now I would say most days it's just slight discomfort, but it used to be where, most days it was pretty painful.
So you've gone to various doctors, I think even had an MRI done on your arms. None of this is working until one of your doctors said something pretty unexpected, had a different idea or a different way of dealing with this.
That's right. One of my doctors suggested I see a pain therapist, and when I was sitting in the pain therapist's practice, she looked at me and she went, "Hey, have you tried antidepressants?" I was pretty confused, and I told her, "No, I haven't. I'm not depressed. You know, I'm frustrated, obviously, by this, but I wouldn't say I'm depressed." And she said, "No, I mean for the pain."
And according to this pain therapist, what is the connection between the feeling, the sensation of pain, and depression?
Well, it's about where antidepressants kind of do their job, if you will. I mean, antidepressants affect chemicals in our brain, and these chemicals like noradrenaline or serotonin, they work to influence our mood, but they also work on pain and the areas in the brain of where emotions happen, basically, and where pain happens. Those are really close together, and that's why antidepressants are also used fighting chronic pain.
And if I understand it correctly, if you're suffering from chronic pain, it may also lead to depressive symptoms, right? But your body's in pain. You don't feel good. You're frustrated.
Right. It's not usually that you slip into what's considered clinical depression, but a large number of people with chronic pain also are in a low mood, basically, because you know you can't really pull your weight at work. As I found out, you can't do much at home because on days where it's really bad, I can't really cook a meal because I can't chop anything. I can't really clean the house, obviously. And that puts you in a low mood. So she prescribed two different antidepressants after I said I was willing to try that, because at that point I was willing to try anything. And I started taking them. And after about 4 weeks, I would say, my symptoms improved pretty dramatically.
Two things to say, I feel, at this point that need to be said. One, obviously we wouldn't be talking to you if this was just some very esoteric or whack doctor, you know, doing something that had never really been done before, and here we're broadcasting it. We're not doing that because this has been tried and tested to the point that there are meta-studies on the other studies. And as you put it in your article, the results of the meta-study examining what actually what we can say about antidepressants against chronic pain, that it's sobering is the word you used.
That's right. This researcher I talked to from the University of Southampton, she was telling me that they, in their meta study, had looked at, I believe, 176 trials with a total of almost 30,000 people. And after looking at all those results and at all those studies, they came to the conclusion that they cannot confidently recommend antidepressants in the treatment against chronic pain.
Yet it worked for you.
Yet it worked for me. And I told her that. I was like, hey, that sounds odd to me because I got so much better after I started taking them. And she wasn't surprised. And she said, no, that makes sense. As researchers, we look what we can reliably recommend for a large number of people. So their recommendations are group-based, and they can never predict how any type of medication is going to affect a specific individual. So it can work for some people, but a lot of the studies that they looked at, they had a small number of participants, and really none of them were long-term. So they don't know anything about long-term side effects or if there's long-term damage. But that doesn't mean that antidepressants never fix chronic pain. It can work for some people, and definitely worked for me.
Carla, first of all, thank you for coming in to talk about this. This is a personal story. I think a lot of people are hesitant to talk about chronic pain because from the outside, a lot of people don't understand it, might even be judgmental and think it's, you know, quote unquote, in your head. I don't know if you've experienced that in your life.
Yeah. It's definitely something that if people cannot see it, they sometimes tend to not believe it or say, you know, like, oh, you know, maybe you just don't want to clean today. Maybe I'm just a little lazy, you know, and oh, you've been talking about this for years. Why are you still talking about
that's
it?
I'm sure that even in the family, like my mom has a lot of chronic pain, and I'll be honest, sometimes I can't stand it when she just keeps bringing it up. So for those kinds of people, it's you, people who address it and say that it's real. That must be great for them. And the takeaway for those people today from everything you learned about this isn't necessarily that you take antidepressants and it'll go away, but at least to look into it, talk to a doctor about it, because for you it certainly worked.
Absolutely. It can work. It may not. And there are, of course, possible side effects. And I've been very lucky that I haven't really experienced any, except for a little sleepiness, which actually worked great for me, because one of the issues I had was that I couldn't really sleep well anymore. So I was very happy about that side effect. But yeah, look into it, talk to your doctor, and you can try it. And if it doesn't work, then it doesn't work. But if it does work, then you're in less pain, which was a game changer for me.
If anyone listening right now has anything to say on this, let us know at su@dw.com. If you'd like to learn more, the article is available at dw.com. It's Why I Tried Antidepressants to Treat My Chronic Pain by Carla Bleicher. There's a link to the meta study if you really want to get in depth into what they can say and cannot say. But again, Carla, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Carla.
Thank you so much.
DW, made for minds.